I call the meeting of the House Environment Finance Division to order. A quorum is not present yet, so we will not move the minutes until we get a quorum. We are going to, members, today we're going to hear the impact on the federal government shutdown on Minnesota's environmental agencies. In addition, we added a section to the agenda presentation from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on the Anoka County Waste Disposal Engineering Closed Landfill. The reason for doing this is to lay some foundation for a component of the bill that we'll be hearing on Thursday. So let me just check if we have a quorum yet. We're still struggling for our quorum. So I think we're going to be starting with the Department of Natural Resources. Assistant Commissioner Meyer and Chief Financial Officer Mary Robinson. And I may interrupt you while if we achieve a quorum and pass the minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members, whatever you need to do, please feel free. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I do have with us our CFO, Chief Financial Officer Mary Robinson, to kind of go through the impacts that we're seeing currently from the federal shutdown to the DNR. And members, I'll be working off a several-page document that should be in your packets. It just says Department of Natural Resources federal shutdown impacts to natural resources. And before I turn it over to our CFO, just really briefly, this is a fluid situation. As we all know, we're monitoring the impacts at a daily level. We do not anticipate that the shutdown will result in major impacts to state programs or DNR constituents, as from our activities, especially in the short term. The majority of our activities will continue as planned, and the document that our CFO will be going through here will describe those impacts. But as I said, it is a fluid issue. If it continues and we get into firefighting season, I think that's where it's going to be somewhat alarming for us as to the work with our federal partners there. And we can go through the rest of our impacts as we see them right now and stand for any questions.
Proceed, Ms. Robinson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for having us. Again, as Mr. Meyer noted, I'll be going through the memo in your packet. I will first be talking about federal funds that are administered by the DNR, and then I will move to federally administered programs here in Minnesota that impact natural resources and would therefore be related to our work. The DNR spent approximately $57 million in federal programs in FY18 and anticipates spending about $60 million in FY19 from a variety of federal agencies, all of which are impacted by the partial government shutdown. These include the Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture, etc. Again, the full list is in your memo. The largest federal funding source that the DNR receives is from the Pittman, Robertson, and Dingell-Johnson Acts, which can be spent on wildlife and fisheries activities, including local public water access sites, environmental review, and hunter education. PRDJ funding comes to the DNR through a continuous appropriation of excise taxes, and because of the nature of this funding source, it is not subject to the shutdown. Together, in FY18, this made up nearly 70% of the DNR's federal funding and is anticipated to be over half of our federal spending in FY19. Approximately 600 DNR employees depend on this funding, but again, because the appropriation is continuous, these employees will not be impacted. Another considerable source of federal funding is the Land and Water Conservation Fund, otherwise known as LACON. LACON will also not be affected by the shutdown. It's appropriated from a federal trust for oil leases and other sources, and provides income to increase and enhance outdoor recreation facilities in local and community parks throughout the state. DNR spent $2.8 million in 18 and has a budget of $2 million in 19 from LACON, but these projects are operating currently and will be reimbursed. The state may award fewer grants in 19 if the shutdown delays our annual apportionment. Turning to federal boat and water safety grants, these also come through a continuous appropriation, and because they don't require any congressional authorization, they won't be impacted. Neither will federal recreation trail programs. Federal recreation trail programs provide funding to develop and maintain recreational trails and trail-related facilities for motorized and non-motorized uses. In 18, the DNR spent $4 million on these activities. The program is funded through federal fiscal year 20, so we have a while for these programs to continue. All DNR grants that operate on a reimbursement basis will draw on state funds while waiting for federal reimbursement and will keep operating in accordance to their federal awards. Some of these grants rely on automated request processes that have allowed them to continue to draw down during the shutdown. The main concern we have with all of these grants is that we cannot make amendments to awards while the shutdown is in place. Now I'm going to turn to programs that could have funding impacted by the shutdown, depending on how long it goes on. Most of our programs run through calendar year 19. However, there are several grants that will run out in June and September of 19 if we do not receive further federal awards. One notable impact is that the DNR would have to ramp down or stop operations of several programs for invasive species. For example, we have a tree inspector program that trains and recertifies 800 professionals annually. If not recertified, the chances that emerald ash borer would spread undetected would increase. This same funding also supports the Urban and Community Forest Program that provides assistance to cities and townships to protect their trees. And this grant runs through June 30. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is another example where funds could be disrupted. It currently funds watercraft inspections in the Great Lakes and is the only source of watercraft inspection in the Great Lakes region. This funding also runs through June 30. The Coastal Zone Management Program funds activities that preserve, protect, develop, restore, and enhance coastal resources along Lake Superior. This program includes DNR activities and grants. The majority of the funding for the six DNR employees that are funded under this grant runs out on June 30, and these activities would have to cease. This program has an estimated budget of just under $1.7 million in the current fiscal year. Other impacts from grants that will end in June or September would include delays in finalizing floodplain maps, a longer wait for repair of local dams, delayed work on parts of the St. Louis River Restoration Initiative, and fewer resources for volunteer fire departments in rural areas of the state. Unless there are questions on that, I will turn to federally managed programs in the state.
Ms. Robeson, I think we might get the minutes done since we have a quorum. And
please.
I've noted that Representative Sundin has been looking over them closely and is moving through.
I move the minutes of the previous meeting.
Representative Sundin moves. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Proceed, Ms. Robeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Federally managed programs that are related to the natural resources. One is, of course, wolf depredation. Federal work on wolf depredation is on hold, and no new cases will start until a federal budget is passed. This is a slow time of year for depredation work, and trapping would commence if there are human safety concerns. There have only been three human safety concerns in the past several years. If we needed to, we could provide funding for wolf depredation work, which is estimated to be less than $20,000 total. Related to national parks and forests, national parks and monuments are open but do not have visitor services or maintenance at this time. Park buildings are closed, so many vendors inside the parks cannot operate. Some park workers for security and essential services may be working without pay. These parks include Pipestone National Monument, Grand Portage National Monument, the Mississippi National River and Recreational Area, including Coldwater Springs, and Voyageurs National Park. Please note that the Friends of Voyageurs National Park have raised funds to open the visitor center for the park for 2 weeks in January. Health and safety services are still available in these parks according to the National Park Service. And as always, local law enforcement can respond to emergencies on these lands. Dumping and waste accumulation are likely occurring in these parks since there's not staff for sanitation services. The DNR doesn't have any specific information on the condition of the parks at this time. With regards to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, overnight camping is not allowed because permits cannot be honored or checked at this time. Day trips do not require permits but are not encouraged during the shutdown. Concerns about impacts on the public of national park closures would, of course, increase as the shutdown continues into the spring. Relates to wildfire management. Wildfire prevention and response efforts are closely coordinated between the DNR, federal partners, and other partners through cooperative agreements, and these agreements are still in place. The primary impacts to wildfire management are to training activities. Typically, wildfire trainings, preparedness activities, and maintenance occur in January and February. Many of these training opportunities have been impacted. DNR staff and other partners are replacing federal instructors where possible, and trainings that can be postponed are being delayed. However, please note that the DNR is not delaying any trainings that are necessary to keep DNR firefighters certified and current. The wildfire season is typically March through June. The cooperative agreements necessary for DNR and federal partners to coordinate fire response are still in place, and the Minnesota Incident Command System is still operating and doing fire dispatch. Federal agencies, fire leadership, and key staff are monitoring phone and email, even though they are not reporting to work. Access to federal aviation resources will be in place by March so that they are available during the typical fire season. If there's potential for a wildfire on federal lands, including a lack of snow, federal fire staff would return to work. Total personnel available or response time should not be impacted, as far as we know, at this time. With relation to the timber harvest, the U.S. Forest Service timber harvest in Minnesota is usually about 30% of the state's activity. Federal timber sales staff are active, and existing timber sales are proceeding during the shutdown. However, loggers are currently working on harvests that were initiated before the shutdown, and it is not clear at this time whether they will start work on new harvest sites. Without sales and harvests proceeding, the shutdown would have to last for several months. With sales and harvest proceeding, the shutdown would have to last for several months in order to have an impact. If the Forest Service were to stop allowing timber sales or new timber harvests or the use of their roads, the impact would be sooner. It's difficult for us to estimate how much activity might shift to state lands, as some federal loggers do not have state permits. They might also have options to harvest on private land or to harvest county timber. The shifts would be greater in parts of the state where the options are limited, such as Cook County. Prolonged delay in future timber sales would affect the timber harvest even after the shutdown ends. There would be a disproportionate effect for loggers in areas of the state that may have federal lands, such as the Arrowhead. In terms of land exchanges, the DNR is currently working with the Forest Service to exchange school trust lands within the BACWA borders for lands outside of those borders. While the U.S. Forest Service is shut down, ongoing and new appraisal work in federal lands will be significantly delayed. However, the DNR is moving forward on any actions it can take to keep the appraisal process moving forward in order to minimize these delays as much as possible. Pending federal land exchanges between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and private or public entities will be delayed. These exchanges often go in front of the Minnesota Land Exchange Board as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The DNR can prepare to accommodate larger numbers of land exchanges in future board meetings to expedite the delayed land exchanges once the shutdown ends. Endangered species consultation is another area that is impacted. They're not being done while the shutdown is in place. Construction, development, and other projects completed with federal funds require endangered species consultations. Private sector projects may require these as part of the federal permitting process. For example, projects that need 404 permits from the Army Corps of Engineers to do construction work in waters and wetlands must have endangered species consultations. This means that projects that require these consultations will be delayed or will carry forward without adequate information as to how the projects potentially affect endangered species. Because projects and permitting across federal agencies are subject to this requirement, it's difficult to estimate all the potential impacts. The final area of potential impact is permitting delays, and I have two of note. The redevelopment of the upper post in Fort Snelling cannot move ahead without National Park Service review of the Section 106 and historic tax credits. The tax credit submittals are currently being held by the by the State Historic Preservation Office until the National Park Service staff can return. The DNR and other non-federal partners will move forward all redesign activities that do not require federal action in order to delay this project as little as possible. Lastly, construction on the Split Rock Lighthouse State Park's new campground site requires a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. While the Army Corps is still active, the review is required by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as part of the permitting process, and these Fish and Wildlife staff are not active. Due to construction restrictions and timings, this may delay that project for up to a year.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of items that concern me. I don't know if you have answers or not. Deputy Commissioner Myers. First one is about the national parks and forests. There's no overnight camping in the Boundary Waters canoe area. It's not allowed because permits cannot be honored or checked. How long does it take to get a permit to camp in the BWCA?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mayor. Members, they have an online registration system similar to the ones that we operate for our state parks. So you can do that instantaneously. I don't think that system's up and running right now. Obviously, the only day use is going on, dog sledding, things like that. Some winter camping as well, which may be being impacted, or people may just be going camping without those permits.
Representative Sundin.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering who's monitoring that. If there's nobody watching the henhouse, you know, up there, it's pretty much a free-for-all what can happen up at BWCA, and I'm just concerned about what's going to happen during the tourist season coming up if there's delays or people aren't registering or whatever can happen up there. It could really be detrimental to the tourism industry.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Sundin, we agree wholeheartedly with your concerns. We don't have any authority to actually operate their reservation system. Similarly, they have an online reservation system for Voyageurs National Park, and if this continues, there will be delays and impacts in some of the businesses that are in Representative Eklund's district. The houseboats and things like that will be impacted. As far as safety issues like that, if there is an issue of safety, we will intervene in the BWCA, as will local law enforcement as well. So we are monitoring that, but we lack authority to do many other things that would be necessary to stand up those park systems.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secondly, the timber harvesting that is going on, a lot of times some of the most select wood on timberlands is accessible only in the wintertime. So I'm just concerned for the pulp and paper industries, wood products industries in the northern part of the state, how they're going to be impacted by this. Just a concern, I guess. Thank you.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, that's a concern for us as well. We do have what's called the Good Neighbor Authority with the Chippewa and Superior National Forest, where we basically put the wood up for them, manage the timber sale, and then they cover our costs, and we give them the net after that for the proceeds. But monitoring those timber sales is something that is probably being lacking right now, at least at the federal level. So, again, where there are issues of concern or safety or environmental degradation that would be raised to a higher level, we'll be looking at those things. But we don't have the staff to operate a national forest system as well as a state forest system, obviously.
Thank you.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Meyer, you probably won't be surprised that I'm asking you about this issue, but I know part of the public plan for how we were going to deal with the chronic wasting disease outbreak in southern Minnesota involved sharpshooters, which I believe were supposed to be contracted from the federal government. So if you could speak to that, and also I know some of our local cities also contract for culling of the deer herds, and even in our suburban areas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, thank you for that question. The CWD work with the USDA, since the DNR is paying for that, most of that activity is still funded. The one person that we were lacking was a federal officer to do the contracts and things like that. But the activities are going on still, at least to our level, and we will begin culling activities this week. There's some concern yet with the city of Lanesboro. We're trying to work through those issues surrounding, and the Fillmore County as well, surrounding our initial request to have access to the newly established Veterans Cemetery, but in discussions with Veterans Affairs and understanding the sanctity of those grounds, we are backing off of that area, looking at other areas close by and perhaps soon-to-be-acquired building site by the state. So we can provide more information, but we are continuing, and luckily the weather hasn't been the best. So those activities are starting to ramp up, and we'll certainly keep you posted. The longer this goes on, there could be other impacts that are out there that we're unaware of related to our CWD response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm concerned with the dumping and the waste accumulation, and I understand that throughout the country, some of our local units of government are, you know, picking up or getting into the national parks to take on that role. Do you know, are there any talks locally here with our units of government to cover the cost for some of the dumping that may be going on right now throughout our national parks and the forests?
Mr. Chair, sure. Representative Lee, we're monitoring that situation. Obviously, the one, if not several benefits of the recent cold snap is to delay some of those people who are outside working on. The other one is the benefit to EAB and other invasive species, obviously. But it's something we're concerned about as the weather warms up, and if this were to continue into, you know, open water camping season, for example, then we have a whole different situation on our hands where we may need to intervene. And, again, we don't have the authority to do some of those things, reservation systems, campground enforcement. We don't have the wherewithal to operate another whole enforcement operation within Voyageurs National Park, for example. And what are the impacts of those resources going to be? So we're monitoring that, and in particular to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area and Voyageurs National Park, something we need to keep our fingers on the pulse of. Grand Portage and Pipestone are a little bit different as they're kind of a drive into viewing facility, and I'm not aware of any impacts at this time, but the visitorship is minimal at best currently. So as we move into spring kind of outdoor recreation season, this whole conversation is going to need to change a little bit as far as our involvement and what's going on if there's not a resolution at the federal level.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Myers, I'm just wondering about ballast water discharges in Lake Superior. If this shutdown continues, who actually monitors the ballast water discharges on the incoming ships in Lake Superior? That EPA or
yeah, that would be a conversation with Pollution Control Agency.
So that may not be happening going forward if this shutdown extends that far.
That'd be a question for them.
Yeah, Representative.
Yeah, concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
They'll be coming up. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of generalities, obviously, in this. One thing I would ask a couple of questions, particularly with regards to the tree inspector program. That's just one that I'm picking out. There's several others. Here it says if they're not recertified, this may result in something. Can you give me some specifics, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, on how these recertification programs take place? And is there anything that's preventing the people who are currently certified, anything that would prevent them from doing this work?
Mr. Meyer. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I do not have all the answers to those questions that in front of me at this point in time. I'll gladly get that information to you as soon as I can. I think, as our CFO stated, the state is cost flowing these grants and these appropriations with the intention of getting reimbursed. How long the state budget can continue to cost share upfront fund all of these programs. Our stuff is minimal, but if you look at some of the other assistance programs that are out there, I don't have any idea how long the state resources can continue at that level.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with some of the things that are going on in the state, what is the DNR doing then to, I'll say, gear up for more visitors in our state parks as a result of some of these activities maybe not being available? We've got a great park system in the state, and I would hope that a lot of people could see this as an opportunity for increasing daily use and and camping at our own state parks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, thank you for that question. We're doing everything we can stay on the course that we always are at this point in time. A lot of our parks are visited minimally. Cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, hiking are the main activities right now. There's some winter camping, and we will need to make sure that we are prepared to take on that influx of new campers should that the shutdown continue at that level.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on page 3, under wildlife or wildfire management, mm-hmm. in the second paragraph underneath that bullet, it says many federal training opportunities have been impacted. Can you tell me exactly how they've been impacted?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, the biggest impact is not having federal workers available to train with us. So, for example, we have a firefighting coordination meeting held in Duluth every year where the federal partners and the state partners come together, not only from Minnesota but from the entire region. That has had to be delayed because of the lack of participation at the federal level. So those types of training activities are just delayed. We need to keep them, get them rescheduled, and make sure everybody's ready to go when fire season does come into play.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you point out on the first page or two here that there's really no impact in many of these areas. And I would point out that I think that the federal government is actually doing a fairly good job in spite of what's going on with regards to the shutdown, you know, compared to, say, 2011 when state government shut things down. I mean, we literally closed our parks. We closed our wayside rests. And a lot of people kind of questioned why. And then we wound up going to the courts to get things to be judged essential and so forth. And as much as I don't like this shutdown, I think that the federal government has provided more opportunities for citizens than the state of Minnesota did back in 2011.
I'm just noting, Representative Fabian, like the federal government.
Representative Hansen, I just got done saying. If you heard what I said, okay?
I did.
So if you want to play games with this, that's fine. I said I don't like this.
I'm complimenting you, Mr. Representative Fabian.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood what you said.
I'm complimenting you. So thank you.
Thank you,
Commissioner. And we'll have the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So Ms. Becker-Kadelka, and I was going to follow up from the end of last session when I think there was a flow chart of the different agency names with Kadelkas and that, so that maybe you could provide that to the committee so that we don't have any confusion about who is which agency and which person is with which agency.
Mr. Chair, I will know. I will know. We are not the same person. I wear glasses. You know, there's been some confusion sometimes. So,
Mr. Chair and members, I also am not Kirk Kadelka. If there was any confusion about that, Mr. Chair and members, Angie Becker Kadelka. I'm the Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the federal shutdown and the impacts to the agency. Bowser has partnerships with the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and projects with the Environmental Protection Agency. As we all know, the federal shutdown is a partial government shutdown, so it's affected agencies in different manners. For example, the Army Corps of Engineers is still up and running, so our work with them and wetland work has continued unaffected. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, there are two agencies that we work with within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the NRCS, and the U.S. FSA, which is the Farm Service Agency. Those have been affected differently. So within the partial government shutdown, if an agency has been appropriated resources that have carried forward, so there's a carry forward dollar amount, they still may be in operation, such as the case with NRCS. The FSA is not in operations right now. And then finally, the U.S. EPA is in the same boat as the FSA, so they are not in regular operations right now. So starting with our two programs with the USDA NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Services, we have two regional conservation partnership program grants. These are competitive grants that we've applied for with the NRCS. They are both still operating as of January 22nd. Neither of these grants have dollars that directly come to Bowser. These grants were done in partnership to get dollars out the door to local governments and farmers. The first one is a small feedlots grant program in southeast Minnesota. That is about $1 million. The second one is project dollars to landowners as part of EQIP, and that's a conservation practice where the federal government will pay for things short-term like cover crops or prescribed grazing. That is about $2 million in 5 watersheds, and that continues. We have 3 program agreements with NRCS. These are also still operating as of January 22nd. The first is a conservation planning program in 7 watersheds working on with landowners creating conservation plans. The second one is technical training and certification. This is an agreement that we have with NRCS. It's a joint position that we share to help build the capacity of our local soil and water district staff to be able to do design work around engineering and environmental practices so that these practices, voluntary conservation practices, can still happen. And then finally, we have a small communications project with NRCS to talk about some of the joint work that happens at the local level. We also have 3 small projects with the Environmental Protection Agency. Because the EPA is not in operations, these projects are not carrying forward right now. So the first one is a functional stream assessment in northeast Minnesota. This is the one that statute directed Bowser to look at how stream restoration could be used as part of creating credits up in wetland credits up in northeast Minnesota. The EPA is the one that was doing this project, and we were a consultant in providing technical assistance on it. That program is on hold, so there's no work being done on that program right now. The wetland banking review oversight, while the Army Corps of Engineers is the one that does the wetland permitting oversight, the EPA actually has oversight over the Army Corps. So this is a fairly small risk, but their oversight to the Corps is on hold right now. And then finally, we have a long-term monitoring study with the US EPA, and this is for monitoring the long-term effects of wetlands. And so we are working with our current resources that we've been appropriated with that program. However, we cannot invoice the EPA at this point.
Ms. Vicker-Kadelka, mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the two ones with NRCS. So if a cooperator or a potential cooperator wanted to contact, they couldn't contact NRCS, but they could contact the SWCD in those offices. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. So the NRCS is still open, so they could contact the NRCS. They can't contact FSA, so the FSA offices are closed. And so they're still able to contact NRCS. And as Commissioner Meyer said, the state of it is fluid right now, and so what we've been told is to just expect week-by-week updates from NRCS as to how long they will be continuing operations.
And one final question. Is this the 3-day open, temporary open, or is that something else that's going on?
Mr. Chair and members, so this is what has been complicated for us as we've been trying to work out our relationships is USDA has 2 agencies. It's the NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the FSA, the Farm Service Agency. No. The Farm Service Agency is closed. It has been open for 3 days, so 2 days last week and I believe today, to help process loans. And then it will close again at the end of today. NRCS, because they have resources that have been appropriated and carried forward, NRCS currently remains in operations until further notice. That's the difference.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, and I just want to make sure I have understanding. It's regarding, first of all, the wetland banking review oversight. Would that potentially have any impact on people applying for wetland credits or for their projects going forward? We've got the construction season coming up. Will that have an impact on those projects?
Mr. Chair and members, it is a fluid situation. As of right now, those projects are still going forward.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one other question I have is on planning projects. I know that Bowser does a lot of planning for and working with folks on RAPs and GRAPs and all those. Mm-hmm. Will the shutdown impact any of those planning processes?
Mr. Chair and members, the planning process that you're referring to is funded with state dollars, and so because those have been funded and don't have federal resources, they remain not impacted.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Becker-Kadelka, back to the wetland banking question. Mm-hmm. What role does the federal government play in that program? Mm-hmm.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, depending on the type of mitigation being requested, there are several different agencies, both at a state and federal level, that may be involved. And so there are some banking projects where if it impacts both and has both federal jurisdiction and state jurisdiction, the federal agency involved is the Army Corps of Engineers. They remain in operations, and so all permit requests that needs both a federal and a state component are still in operations.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so one of the things that we've been working on for a number of years here in the legislature is the 404 assumption. If the state of Minnesota now had assumed 404 permits, would we be where we are today with regards to the wetland program?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, it's a little bit of a guess on my part because it's not there. As of right now, the 404 assumption would have the state having one piece. So instead of it being both a federal component and a state component, the federal part is assumed by the state. And so that means what happens is that the permittee would only have to go through one permit process, all of the same level of stringency, but it would only be going through the state level. And therefore, the federal government wouldn't, if this moves on and forward, the federal government would not be involved in the permitting process.
Thank you.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka, proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, moving on, the U.S. Department of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Service Agency. So as I mentioned before, the Farm Service Agency is not in operations. As Mr. Chair noted, they have been open for 3 days to help process loan applications and are closing again at the end of today. This is the one that has impacted our agency and landowners the most because of our Minnesota CREP initiative. And Mr. Chair, per your request to give the new members of this committee a brief background on the Minnesota CREP program, the Minnesota CREP was signed by the state of Minnesota and the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Service Agency in January of 2017 as a 60,000-acre initiative and a $525 million program that would leverage federal dollars going directly to landowners. The reason that this is important to Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. We have Representative Heintzman.
Thank you. Just a question. Looking at the slide here on page 3, I think the number is 6. I don't know if that's my mic or what, but it says Minnesota CREP on hold since August 17th. Is that affected by the shutdown? Maybe you explained that and I missed it.
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, it's a good lead-in, and if you'll bear with me, I will get to that in 2 slides.
Proceed.
So the Minnesota CRP status, and the one reason that legislative bodies in the past have provided state resources to this program is we know that there are approximately 600,000 acres of CRP that are expiring over the next 5 years. And this is the Conservation Reserve Program. On average, about half of those acres are retained or re-enrolled by landowners, and this all depends on whether or not there are sign-ups that go on, landowner interest. The Minnesota CREP is a 60,000-acre initiative, which means we are still projecting a net loss of acres in CRP at a little over 200,000 acres. So the CREP scope is 54 county areas. You'll see on the map there. It's a voluntary approach that focuses in on the environmentally sensitive land. It's voluntary, it's permanent, and it's targeted to just three practices. Practices around filter strips or buffers, around wetlands, and around wellhead protection for drinking water. And as I mentioned before, so it's involved, the program is involved directly with both a federal component and a state component. So the state component is the state's Reinvest in Minnesota Rim Reserve Program. And this is where, in statute, the state will hold, and Bowser holds it on behalf of the state, an easement. And that easement, then, the landowner will voluntarily agree to the restrictions on that easement, such as building or development, in return for a payment. That's combined with the federal program, the federal CRP program, that is has been enacted through past federal farm bills. The way that this program works is that the USDA part of about $350 million goes directly to landowners for payments and for paying for those practice restorations. Then the state is responsible in this Minnesota CREP for all of the other components, so partially of landowner payments, but for all of the technical assistance, for the engineering work, and for any sort of extra work around easements that we call roundouts. Benefits to Minnesotans: keep soil on the land. It's a water storage and treatment in our wetlands, holding back water temporarily. The wellhead protection is to provide vulnerable drinking water protection and to enhancing grasslands and wetlands for habitat.
Representative Becker-Finn, Becker-Kadelka, Representative New has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to Representative Heintzman's question. You had said that you were going to answer that in the next couple of slides, and I'm not sure that we got there. It says that this has been on hold since August 17th. So I guess just to be very clear, the question is, how is this affected directly by the shutdown, the current shutdown, as opposed to the fact that this has been on hold for months?
Mr. Chair, members, let me skip ahead to that slide. So here's our status. So on August 17th, the Minnesota CREP was put on a processing hold, which was completely expected. That processing hold was for the federal government fiscal year end of September 30th. So we expected that hold, and that was to finish everything up for the end of their fiscal year to make sure everything was processed by October 1. Then, on September 30th, because there was no farm bill, there was no continuing resolution, there was no new farm bill, it stayed on hold. So then there were still no applications that could be taken. That lasted then until December 20th when the farm bill was signed. So we were excited and ready to start gearing up again. However, on December 22nd, then the shutdown started. So that's the connection between the August 17th overall and the shutdown. Is the shutdown then for the last month has been the reason why this program continues to be on hold as unable to take applications.
So as a follow-up, you said that, so what was happening for the three-day window that they were functioning again? What were their applications being processed? How was that interaction taking place?
Mr. Chair and members, there was no impact to the CREP. The CREP did not start up again, so the CREP still had no applications. The three-day window was simply to help producers or farmers process loans, and so that was just the loan program is why they started up.
We might need to catch up a little bit on time here. So,
Mr. Chair and members, to date we funded 12,000 acres for over $104 million investment, and that has been since the August 17th shutdown and previously. So in the last 5 months, there's been no signups to the Minnesota CREP. One of the things that we are cognizant of is the lost momentum, and we know that once programs shut down, it takes time for them to gear up and start up again. So it is a combination of both the federal farm bill and the shutdown that is impacting the Minnesota CREP right now. We also anticipate more lag time. When the federal government does start up again, we know that it will take time for all of those gears to rework before the Farm Service Agency is able to allow the state to start taking applications. And we realize that come spring, farmers are going to be busy in planting, and we know that that's a lag time anyway, as it should be. And so we anticipate that this lag will probably be seen until late spring or summer.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, if there are any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at the Environmental Initiative thing on Friday, and one of the complaints I have heard about CREP, this CREP program, is it's so expensive. Well, I just sat down and did some math, and 60,000 acres and $500 million is $8,000 per acre. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, so those dollar amounts are not only for payments to landowners, but is also restoration. And so that there's a significant dollar amount that goes into taking something that maybe was a wetland at one point in time, but now has been cropped over the course of several years or decades, and turning that back into the wetland that it used to be, or restoring it. And so many of those dollars are taking that environmentally sensitive land and restoring it back to those habitats.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative McGinnis.
That still seems over $8,000 an acre. Still seems high. It would be good to know the actual dollar that is being spent on restoration so we could redo our math and see what's the dollar on restoration and how many acres that is.
Mr. Chair and members, we do have estimates on that, and we'd be glad to provide them.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, do you have any comparisons between this shutdown and the shutdown in 2013, federal shutdown?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
And Mr. Chair, members, the Minnesota CREP was not in existence at that point in time, so we don't have a comparison to that. And I do not know personally what the other impacts with the Farm Service Agency or NRCS were.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
As the Pollution Control Agency is coming up, I do want to note we have several smaller agencies. Minnesota Conservation Corps, we have a handout. They will not be testifying, and we will be putting that on the committee website along with the other handouts. So Mr. Strohmeyer is handing out the handout. Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Representative Green made a good point. I would ask that you contact these other groups and even the people who are here testifying today, DNR, MPCA, and give us some detailed information about how this shutdown compares to the 2013 shutdown and the impact.
Thank you, Representative Hagen. I think they're all the other organizations, with the exception of the Conservation Corps, are here and can hear that request. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that does. I was going to ask the question again, but if it's generically out there, that's fine. Because I'd like to know more about more than just a short-term effect. Was there a long-term effect, and what is that? Or what was that compared to what we have now?
I think they should be able to hear that, and if not, we'll follow up with them directly. Pollution Control Agency, Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greta Gauthier. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Legislative and Intergovernmental Relations at the MPCA. And we have two presentations for the committee today. The first on the shutdown, impacts of the federal partial shutdown, and then the second, an update on our work at cleaning up the Andover landfill, the WDE landfill in Andover. So we'll start with the partial federal government shutdown. And with me today is our CFO, Joshua Bunker, and I'm going to turn it over to him to start.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joshua Bunker. I serve as the Chief Financial Officer for the Pollution Control Agency. EPA, as you heard a little earlier, is certainly one of the agencies that was affected by the shutdown on the 22nd. They had a short amount of operating cash to continue to operate for a couple days after that, and finally shut down on the 28th. We received federal funding primarily from the EPA. They provide us about 97% of all our federal funding on an annual basis. The other 3% is from the Department of Defense for cleaning up some of the former sites that the Department of Defense actually occupied for a while here in the state, so cleanup funds. Our staff and programs that are federally funded are not immediately impacted by the shutdown itself. We have an electronic banking relationship, if you will, as you heard from DNR as well, where we receive a certain percentage of the funds that were appropriated to us, granted to us from the federal government. Those are held in an electronic banking relationship, and so we have funding that is in place to cover the majority of all of our expenses through early April. And so right now we continue to draw down those funds as needed as we have activities, whether they be payments for projects or staff salaries themselves, out of those federal funds. Our appropriations have been in the neighborhood of $20 million a year to cover approximately 110 FTE within the agency. And I should mention, as far as activities as well, that our emergency response activities in the state to respond to spills or other environmental catastrophes are paid by state funds. And so we have the ability to respond that would be uninterrupted right now by what's happening at the federal level. We do have three FTEs, however, in an award that, due to timing and the shutdown, that have now moved from direct federal funding over to state funding. And so, if you will, we are floating three FTE worth. At this time, those salaries that were relying upon that federal grant amount to approximately $60,000 for those three FTE from October 1st through present, where the state right now is using those funds. We will certainly follow up with the questions from Representative Green earlier about comparing to the earlier shutdown, but one thing that we have experience of, I can speak to directly, is that all expenses that were paid for by the state were fully reimbursed by the federal government once the government came back again. Our federal programs themselves cover air and water pollution control, planning, monitoring programs, Superfund site management, brownfields programs, underground leaking storage tanks, Great Lake program activities, and grants for local watershed studies.
Mr. Chair.
And just Mr. Bunker and Representative Sedin had had a question earlier about ballast water. I don't know if either of you can answer that, and then we'll go to Representative Fabian.
Chair and members, our ballast water activities are paid for with state funds right now, and so none of the monitoring or actions related to those permits have been affected.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bunker, you mentioned the previous shutdown in 13, and you said that any state resources, financial resources, were reimbursed by the federal government. Two questions. What was the source of what fund was the source of the dollars that were used to cover those, and how much was that total bill?
Mr. Chair, members, I would have to look at our records from a couple years ago to be able to answer that question exactly. We will certainly get back to you.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we pulled together some information about what some of the further impacts could be if the shutdown continues. So big picture, there will be delays in our work if the shutdown continues. So, for example, remediation projects with federal contractors, such as the St. Louis River Estuary and Duluth Harbor project that's underway right now, that might be delayed if the EPA shutdown continues or if the Department of Health's funding for risk evaluation and well advisories were to run out before the federal government came back. We have some municipal variances for chloride discharge that are awaiting EPA Region 5 to give them preliminary review. We have five TMDLs from five watersheds across the state that are waiting for EPA to give them either final or preliminary approval. And those include the South Fork of the Crow River watershed, the Snake River watershed, the Lake Superior South watershed, the Minnesota River Mankato stretch, and the Minnesota River Greater Blue Earth watershed. So those five are waiting at EPA Region 5. So our processes are always sending things there for preliminary review, then we come back and do work, and then we send things there for final review, and then and so forth. So EPA Region 5 has been shut down since December 28th. If the shutdown, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, if the shutdown goes to 2 months, then we will start seeing delays in approval for municipal wastewater permits. There are eight municipal discharge permit, the MPDES permits, that would be affected if it goes out another month. And those are Alexandria, Detroit Lakes, Litchfield, Hibbing, Melrose, Redwood Falls, Buffalo, and the Met Council's Empire facility, which is down in Empire Township, which is in between Coates and Farmington, Minnesota, south of the Twin Cities. So those eight permits, in a couple weeks, we will have delivered those to EPA for final approval. But if EPA is not back, then there will be delays there. So that kind of gives you an overview. If we get out further than 2 months, then we'll have a lot more things to tell you. But for now, that is our shutdown impact, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On these potential issues with these eight municipal wastewater discharge permits, are these renewals or are these new? And what's the fallback, if we're, particularly if you're simply going to renew an existing permit?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lewick, I do not believe any of them are new facilities. These are five-year permits, so every year we're renewing some of them. We have several hundred of these permits across the state. Under the delegation agreement we signed with EPA, in which EPA delegates to us authority to enforce and carry out federal water law in Minnesota, or portions of it, under that, we have to send a certain percentage of our municipal wastewater permits to them each year for them to, they have to rule that they have no objection. It's a clause in the Clean Water Act, Federal Clean Water Act. So these eight water discharge permits for these eight municipalities will be awaiting a no objection ruling from EPA Region 5.
Let me look.
Just to follow up on that, so I guess what I'd like to know is how close are these to expiring, or are these already expired and we're working in that situation where we're at 5 years and one day and now we're just kind of rolling around trying to get everything straightened out to renew it?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lewick. It's the way it works is if you have a permit and you reapply before it expires, then you are not considered out of compliance or expired. So the fact that we have all of their new permits and paperwork just about ready to send up to EPA tells me that they have all reapplied. So therefore, I doubt any of them will have an expired permit, but I can certainly double check on that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, Ms. Gauthier, these municipalities will continue operating their wastewater treatment facilities under the current permit.
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, yes.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For future possible bills, studied a little bit about this, and generally Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has a little bit stricter regulations than does the EPA. in a lot of cases. So if for the most part, when you guys are renewing these permits, they almost always get okayed by the EPA because we have some pretty strict guidelines here. Is there any way for in future reference that we could say, as long as we're meeting all these, and maybe try to do away with this extra okay from the EPA when we've met all the standards?
Ms. Gothier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, thank you for your question. I think I want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. Are you saying this no objection ruling, you would like to get rid of that last piece of it, or just having any Minnesota water quality standards that differ from the federal?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, what I'm saying is that right now I think I don't think that our standards mirror exactly the EPA's. I think ours are more stringent. And is there any way to put something in place to say as long as we have met at least the minimum of the EPA, why are we going back and asking for an okay when our permitting process is probably stricter already?
Ms. Gothier.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that clarification, Representative Green. I will have to check. It may be a requirement under federal law, but I will certainly check with our attorneys. I believe the Clean Water Act may have specific directions for states that we have to send certain permits to EPA regional offices for their approval. But I will double check to make sure that that is from the Clean Water Act.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to just go right into the landfill program. I do want to note that we do have a letter in your packet from Explore Minnesota. I'll just read the our agency receives no direct federal dollars and there's no direct impact on our operations due to the federal shutdown. The Minnesota Zoo has a letter. I will ask them to come up at the very end of it to kind of go through that because that has a little more of an impact. And I would finally ask if Representative Scott wants to come to the table since we're going to be talking about a landfill in your district. If you want. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're going to give you a brief update today on the WDE landfill in Andover. For those new members, this landfill is a closed landfill, one of 110 closed landfills around Minnesota. Every year we rank our landfills in terms of the hazard, and this is the top of the list, the most urgently in need of cleanup. So I would be remiss if I didn't say there's three ways for us to manage the waste that everybody produces. We can either prevent it, manage it, or clean it up. And today we're going to talk about cleaning it up, which is by far the most expensive way to deal with it. So in 1994, the legislature created the closed landfill program. And under that program, it was the legislature determined that because everyone has put trash into these landfills, therefore it made sense for the state of Minnesota to be able to take long-term management of them and clean up. So under this law, Minnesota is responsible for managing closed landfills that were permitted to hold mixed municipal solid waste. That's the trash that you and I throw away in our homes every day. And we do this for landfills that are enrolled in the closed landfill program. So the goal was to mitigate risks to the public and the environment. There are 114 closed landfills eligible to be enrolled, and 110 are now enrolled. The reason they're eligible is that they did not have financial assurance back when this law was passed. And from that point in time, 1994 forward, landfills are required to have financial assurance. So this program is for those 114. And you can see on the map there, I apologize for the smallness, but just kind of that they're all over the state. So we do score them every year. And we look at the degree of the hazards at each site. What is the threat to groundwater, to surface water? What is the level of methane gas? We look at what underlying conditions could exacerbate that, like bedrock or other geological underlying conditions, whether or not there's an impact on drinking water. We also looked at likelihood that people would be exposed to these risks at this site and other factors. So every year we rank all of those 110 to come up with our priority list for cleanup, and WDE is number one. So these are some pictures. The one on the left is an old picture from the early 1970s of some barrels that were disposed of at the WDE hazardous waste pit. And then on the right is a picture of some of the soil that we have found that is contaminated at that site. So just to orient you, so the road on the right-hand side of the slide is Hanson Boulevard. This is north of 694. So this landfill is a one-third of an acre hazardous waste pit in the red circle there that is inside a larger 122-acre landfill. So in the early 1970s, we believe 6,600 barrels were buried in the pit, and they contain PCBs, paint wastes, heavy metals, solvents, and volatile organic chemicals. We do have four mitigation systems running at that site, two air and two water systems to control the spread of contamination. However, those are expensive, and they cost the state of Minnesota about $600,000 a year to run. That's another reason that this landfill is at the top of our list. There are about 20,000 people living within a mile of this. Of course, back in the 60s, when this site was created here as a town dump, there was nothing there. And it was kind of a common practice back then to put dumps into wetlands next to creeks or rivers because the wetland was thought to be a wasteland. That was just the level of knowledge that we had at the time. So in this committee, you will see that again and again in our presentations, that these old landfills are right next to creeks and in wetlands, which, of course, creates a lot of other problems than if they were not in a wetland but on higher ground. And just to give you some context, too, there's baseball diamonds on the bottom of the screen there. The Little League plays there in the summer. Right off the screen on the left side, there is a high school where there are outdoor football games and so forth. And then, of course, Coon Creek is going right across to the north of the landfill. So initially, we requested in 2016 and 2017, we got $12 million to clean up this landfill. This slide represents a cross-section of that hazardous waste pit, that little red circle we just looked at. And when we opened it up in September of 2017, you know, we got the bonding dollars and the bonds were sold and the funds were made available and then we started the work. We found out that the liner for the hazardous waste pit was really pretty much gone, and that the soil around and under the pit was far more contaminated than we had thought, and that that first aquifer there of groundwater was also contaminated. So we found out we would have to excavate another 20 feet of soil under this third of an acre and do additional work. So and here's a picture of some of the soil that was excavated. So just to be clear of the previous history of funding, in 2016, we did get $650,000 from the general fund. In 2017, then we got the remainder of the $12 million we needed, $11.35 million from general obligation bonds. So we came back last year after finding this additional contamination and asked for an additional $6 million, moving the cost totally from $12 million to $18 million. We did get that $6 million request, but in the form of appropriation bonds backed by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So there was a lawsuit served last year related to the constitutionality of those appropriation bonds, and so MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, has decided not to sell those bonds until the lawsuit is either settled or completed or withdrawn or whatever. So We don't have that $6 million in hand right now. We had anticipated those bonds being sold last November. So in September, late August, we had gone ahead with the bidding process for this site. And now that bidding process is complete, and we have found out that our cost will be up another chunk of money, $4.3 million additional to the $6 million that we are already needed last year, another $4.3 million because of the cost of putting up a custom building on the site over the pit. So the fumes and so forth in the pit are pretty toxic. So we knew we had to put a building over it and then pump the air through that building. And also the workers, of course, would all have hazmat suits on. We thought that building could be made from prefab pieces. And our contractor came in and said, no, it cannot. It's going to have to be custom built on site. So that's a big chunk of the $4.3 million. Also, the transportation cost, because this is toxic waste, it has to be destroyed and handled at a special facility that can burn it at a very high temperature. And we do not have one of those in Minnesota. The closest one is in Illinois. So the cost of hauling this waste to Illinois and then the incineration, and then after it's incinerated, it is stored permanently in part of that facility in Illinois, that those costs are higher than we had anticipated. So we have been in two-way communication with the city, with the community, and this slide here shows you the additional 10.3 we need, along with the $12 million we already received, brings the total cost for cleanup of this site to $22.3 million. As of January 1st of this year, we have spent about a little over a million of the funding we had already received. So I've been asked to talk about the timeline as well. So we've, as I said, been in communication with the city. We had a big meeting in the community center last year, standing room only. The community is very concerned that this cleanup take place in the late fall and into the winter, when homeowners will not have their windows open and kids will not be playing outside. So we are doing our best to do the cleanup in that way. So if the situation now is that our the contractor that bid, and we had one bid, but it's a very reputable company that works across the Midwest. They have decided that their bid is on the table for a certain length of time. And then once that time expires, then we would either ask them to give us another extension or an extension on that amount of time, or we would have to start the bidding process over. So right now, the bidder has, the contractor has said their bid will be on the table through early March. So because we have to do some paperwork, and we have checked with MMB, so if the legislature were to make the dollars available by either passing them in a bonding bill, or Representative Scott has a bill for a cash general fund appropriation, by the end of February, then we would be able to get the cleanup done in the late fall and early winter of 2019. If that doesn't happen, then we go into March, and then we would ask our contractor to extend, and if they do, great, and if they don't, then we would start the bidding process over again, which either way will put us back into 2020 doing the cleanup. So I have experts here from our remediation program to take your questions, but that's basically the update on where we're at.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gallier, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So did the contractor give the MPCA any indication of how much higher that bid may come in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eklund, do you mean if we ask for an extension or if we had to rebid? Or do you,
Representative Eklund?
If it has to be rebid.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eklund, no. They did not.
Representative Eklund.
So do you know the contractor well enough, or maybe you can get an indication, or is this somebody that you haven't dealt with before?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Hans Navy. I'm the manager of the closed landfill program. The one bidder that did respond to our inquiry, they're a company we worked with before. They've done work all over the country. Part of the bidding process was that they submit other projects they've worked on. So we do know them well in terms of specific conversations about how costs would change if this project moved forward. This is not conversations we've had with them at this time.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the total cleanup costs and wanting to understand, you've talked about the hazardous waste going to Illinois, but from a landfill, you will have methane gas. And what are your plans for the methane gas, and are they included in the total cost?
Mr. Chair, members, so at this landfill site, there's the issue of the hazardous waste pit. There's also methane generated from breakdown of the garbage that is the rest of the area of the waste footprint. At this facility and also other closed landfill sites, we're trying to recover as much of the methane as possible. When there's enough methane to recover and burnt off before it's discharged to the atmosphere, that is what the practice is, and that's what's happening at this landfill.
So,
Representative McGinnis.
If I could follow up then, when I was looking at the sources of greenhouse gas that are produced by the state, I was dumbfounded to find that our closed landfill program was the source of 18%, which seemed incredibly high to me. So you are telling me that this particular landfill is not part of that 18% of the state's emissions.
Mr. Nabe.
Yes, so to answer that question, I would need to know if that 18% is what is captured by our systems, or if what is destroyed by our flare system is removed.
If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Yep. For the record, my name is Jamie Wallerstedt. I'm the supervisor at the MPCA, and I am involved with the closed landfill program. Mr. Chair, members, the greenhouse gas emissions are, I think the 18% that you were looking at is an aggregate of all the closed landfill sites. We do emit greenhouse gases through our passive systems, which just means that the landfill is just venting the methane gas to the atmosphere when we don't generate enough methane to actually flare it. We also then, at some of our sites where we're still generating a lot of methane, we do actively flare that, but there is some that then goes to the atmosphere still.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I've heard the answer for this particular landfill, and it you are flaring the methane, which means it's not as bad. But for the state's responsibility for preventing greenhouse gases, we have to do better. That for landfills to be 18% when it's just way too high, particularly considering everything else that is included in that number. It's all the rest of the state and all the rest of the state's activities. So we'll have another conversation about that.
Mm-hmm. Like Representative Fisher and then Representative Green and Representative Heinzman. Before you get to each of those, why are we using the general taxpayers instead of the closed landfill program? Could you just, the timing on that we are unable to actually use the funds in the closed landfill program?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there is a fund called the Closed Landfill Investment Fund that was created by the legislature in 1999. So remember the Closed Landfill Program in 1990, then the Closed Landfill Investment Fund in 1999, to provide a long-term source of funding for these 114 eventually closed landfills for which the state has perpetual responsibility. So the legislature appropriated, I believe, $20 million in four installments over 4 years of $5 million each back right around the turn of the century. And then that became the beginning of the Closed Landfill Investment Fund, and the legislature stipulated in 1999 that the money could not be used until the beginning of fiscal year 2021. So that will be July 1st, 2020. It's the beginning of fiscal year 21.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just have a couple of comments and try to keep it limited. First of all, I just from Ms. Gaudier, if I could get an understanding, as I look at the cross-section of the, and I can't tell what slide number it's on, our page 5, it shows that you've got a, that there's a barrier wall that goes down into the groundwater layer. Is that just around the hazardous pit, or is that across the entire landfill?
Ms. Gaudier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher, that barrier wall is just around the pit.
Just around the pit.
And I believe that was put in the late 80s with EPA funds.
Okay. And
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be my last question. I can follow up with some of the others later. In terms of testing for the monitoring wells, do they test for what chemicals and that's coming out in the groundwater in the surrounding area?
Mr. Nate.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members, so the monitoring that's done is for the chemicals of concern at the landfill. It's a standard suite that we've seen before, and it's also changed over time. So what we're monitoring for are PCBs, volatile organic compounds. This includes things like paint wastes. These are the main contaminants of concern. The hazardous waste pit are volatile organic compounds.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to provide that standard list if that would be helpful.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first is just a quick comment that, you know, when you talk about getting another bid or asking them to extend the bid, as someone who's worked a lot in contracting, I would find it very difficult myself to extend a bid, and especially on something like this where the gas price alone could affect this bid by thousands if not millions of dollars. So, you know, the urgency is probably there. But the question is, you know, we're in the groundwater now, and I do see the barriers, but in serving on this committee, I've noticed that in our area, as and I'm sure it's well across the state, where an aquifer, whether it's high or low, if it goes up or down, all three in our area, there's three, one above, you know, above the, on top of each other, and they all go up and down together. And so, you know, we don't always know what's happening underneath there. And is there any potential for this leaching to get into some of the groundwaters or even some of the rivers, such as the Mississippi River, if this is, you know, the longer this goes on?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. So this is the concern that we have. The response work that's been done to date has been monitoring to get a clear idea of where the contamination is. And we feel like we have a good idea of the answer to that. Also, what's important about this is it's only a temporary solution. The work that's been done up till now has been to limit previous impacts. We're detecting chemicals from this landfill in the adjacent creek and the groundwater, both on and off the property. So there's several stages over time to install different kinds, now four different systems, to do what really is just initial containment. Rana, if without the full excavation of this hazardous waste pit, we're on a trajectory to be doing this for a very long time, making very little progress. That's why we're before you today to talk about additional funding for the project.
Representative Hainsman.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought actually Representative Wagenius was going to ask this question because usually we're talking about water. And so I'll just go ahead and ask since I didn't hear it asked yet. We see here, I think, on page 5 that 20,000 people live within 1 mile of this location. Mm-hmm. Is there a slide that's been generated or any information that's been generated to look and see if we don't act, if we don't resolve this issue soon, how many people across this general area, maybe further, could otherwise be impacted?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Heintzman, thank you for your question. Yes, we have looked at that. Public health and safety is a number one concern for us. So many of the people that live around there, they're drinking water. They're on city water. The aquifer for the city water is several hundred feet down. So it is far away from this very shallow contaminated, this first contaminated aquifer here, which is about 30 feet down, as I recall, 35. So the good news is that the city water supply is completely safe. We did learn that some folks that lived nearby had, because this is the Anoka sand plain, so it's very sandy soil, you can go to Home Depot and buy a drill and drill yourself a well pretty easily. So we did identify, working with the city and the county, a handful of those. We've checked them all, and their water is not contaminated. They are not being affected by this. So, and just to understand, too, the water for Coon Creek is going to flow into Coon Creek from either side. So it would only, Coon Creek would kind of is a barrier for the, if there is contamination from going, it won't flow out of the creek on the other side, right? So, but we did check very thoroughly with all of the drinking water and groundwater. And there is no damage right now.
President Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up then. So is there, have you guys produced any kind of a document estimating the potential impact if we don't act or not? Is that not been done?
Mr. Nabe. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members, you're talking about, there's two kinds of impact, really. One is financial. You're talking about human health impact, yes. So as right now we're in a stable situation. We've got multiple systems in place to arrive at a stable situation where we can say there's not an ongoing human health impact that we're concerned about. If there were an ongoing impact, we'd be taking additional action. Once we've got to a point of stability in terms of human health impact, then we have some time to go back and look at what long-term solution might be. And that's the point that we're at right now.
And Mr. Chairman, so again, this is a high-cost landfill right now because all of those four mitigation systems are running all the time. So that, again, is about $600,000 a year, and that is also a factor in cleaning this up is long-term, it, you know, cost savings to the state.
Ms. Gauthier, it seems like whenever we open one of these up, we have surprises. Is 4.3, I mean, are your cost estimates realistic, or once we open this up, we find more surprises, more toxic, more barrels, more stuff? And I'll go to Representative.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members. Yes, as you, I'm sure, have experienced, there's always unknowns. To get to the point that we're at right now, there has been a lot of, I'm going to say, pre-design, pre-construction work. So we feel like we've got a good understanding of, to the degree that you can, without doing excavation, knowing what's underground. This is based on borings and other data that we've collected. So we feel good about the point that we're at now. And we don't think there's, other than the normal amount of surprises that are inherent to the process, we don't think there's an additional uncertainty factor with this project.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I did step out just for a minute earlier, but I just want to be clear on the fact that there's just one bid in for this project. Can you give me just a little more clarity as to why? I'm sure that there are other companies that do this, although fairly specialized.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Nate.
Mr. Chair, members. The feedback we've got is that the requirements for experience that were placed on the contractor limited the number of companies that bid. So because of the sensitivity of the project, the adjacent community, the high levels of contamination. We were, it was very important to us that we went with a contractor that had experience, and only one met the experience requirements.
Representative Quinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would actually be for Representative Scott. The community, are they comfortable with what has the processes that have taken place here so far?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian. My community is very anxious just to get this done. The meeting that we had, I think it was actually November of 2017, as Ms. Gauthier pointed out, it was a standing room only. And so people are very concerned. And so I think there's just a level of comfort that that the people that are the professionals in this world are going to be able to take care of the issue and get it out of our community. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Thanks. Thank you. House File 233 will be on our agenda on Thursday. I do want to note in your packet there's a letter from the Minnesota Zoo about some impacts and the loss of federal funding for their prairie butterfly conservation program. And these will be posted, Mr. Strohmeyer. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting.